Welcome to Big Adventures. This is Brian Durker. Well, you know, I've got a lot of old friends that have been on this show, but this is probably my oldest friend. We were just 7 or 8 years old when we met, and boy, have we spent a lot of life together and in a lot of adventures together. And by golly, I've got Mike Yard, son of George Yard, who we've already had on the show. This is more than you can get into one show as far as what we've experienced together. And it's been adventure after adventure, whether it's early days riding bikes, playing football in high school, riding horseback and roundups out on the ranch. We went up to Alaska when we were out of high school. And then we spent about 20 years together doing scientific work in Grand Canyon. We also spent high water and low water in Grand Canyon. In 77, it was less than 1,000, and in 83, it was almost 100,000. And so we've got a lot to share with you about what we've shared, and we'll have to have him on again, I can tell you that, because we've just got too much stuff to cover. But old Mike and Brian, good friends. Mike, I welcome you. So to start, let's go to our childhoods. We both grew up doctors' sons, right? When my dad was a doctor in Flagstaff, there were only four GPs in Flagstaff. And your dad came soon thereafter, right? Our families grew up side by side. You know, our siblings all know each other and, you know, we're family. But let's talk about our dads for a second. Your dad is huge part of my life, far more than mine because my dad took off at a fairly young age. But George is a remarkable man, your father, and he put me under his wing alongside his kids. And let's talk about George. Let's start out there.
The funny thing is originally he was struggling with whether he was to practice medicine in Prescott, which at the time he thought was rather, you know, persnickety people, versus Holbrook, and he settled upon Flagstaff. Now, why he even contemplated Holbrook, I have no idea, but...
Yeah, this is new stuff for me. Go.
You know, he grew up in that Bisbee Tombstone area and went to school at U of A, came from an agrarian, you know, family, running ranches, things like that. Did a little stint of mining. And why he got into practicing medicine rather than being a big vet, I have no idea. He might have been masquerading here in Flagstaff as a doctor, where in reality he was a vet. That's always been wondered. But ever since the time that he got here in Flagstaff, he's loved this community. And so it's been an interesting ride along with George Yard.
Well, and just a real quick segue on that. You know, through the years, I've watched him practice medicine on his son, Mike Yard, and he should have been a vet.
Thanks. No, I think he took his practice as if he was dealing with large animals. You know, he has a... what we call a congenital defect in my family. He has a love for big animals and things like that. I've acquired that same questionable love for large animals, whether they're horses or cows and things like that. But he enjoyed practicing medicine here. Even as a kid, we used to do operations on skunks to make pets out of them in the backyard. So he was an interesting father to have, for sure.
That is an understatement. But to get back where you were going with his doctoring, he did a lot of great things for the community people. And I know those old-time doctors would do house calls. And I mean, his reputation has always been like top notch reputation as far as being a community doctor and stuff like that. But wouldn't you agree his first love was to be a rancher?
Yeah. And he ended up, I think he settled into Flagstaff and recognized that he had some little missing element to his life. So from that point on, he ended up acquiring different ranches through time, and his children by default were indentured servants on those ranches.
And friends of his children.
As well as friends and anybody else. Any free labor was, you know, perfect. And he spent, that's where he spent most of his free time. I think, you know, if it wasn't for practicing medicine, he was out there looking for cattle.
And he could be sitting with us right now, and I'm sure he would agree that medicine was kind of a sidecar to his ranching. But he had some fantastic holdings as far as ranches. Let's just touch on that. He had that place out near Woods Canyon.
The one in Young.
That was one of my favorites. The Bar Axe was a fantastic spread that he had down there.
And then later on, the YBARD there in Perkinsville. All of them really beautiful places.
And I learned so much from him about cowboying and stuff. We'd go on those roundups. But there is, since this is Big Adventures with Brian Durker and you're the Big Adventures, share with people the little roundup you guys were on in Woods Canyon when you had the rattlesnake, defanged rattlesnake in the cooler or whatever. Tell us this story. It's a fantastic story. And it pissed him off.
Yeah, but, you know, you have to realize my dad, as you well know, was a practical joker. He liked doing practical jokes all the time. And at that time, I think ranchers in particular, but people out of doors, were probably overly concerned and afraid about snakes. And for that reason, ranches, cowboys would typically clear an area of rattlesnakes so that children in that area wouldn't get bit and things like that.
They killed them.
And so I grew up with that. And one of the things, I thought they were beautiful animals, and I was always grabbing roadkills or some of these snakes that they'd clear and make belts and other things out of them. And
as I recall, you'd often dissect them and...
Yeah, I was, you know, I've been interested in biological things since a child.
Day one.
This one time... we were riding kind of on the X Triangle, and we were down off the basin area. And I think I was with Michael Pfluger at the time, and we encountered a beautiful western rattlesnake. And I had known that even if you kill a snake, you know, you can get struck by them. And so I remember removing the fangs from it. I thought I had killed it, and I removed the fangs and I rolled it up in my Levi coat. And we met down there in the basin area. My dad was still out. There were a number of hands, and we'd all kind of collect around cooler, which in this case had beer. I was underage, so that was off limits, but I decided to coil up the snake into the cooler, as so that people would open it up and there's a snake there. And it was kind of a fun little pastime to watch people.
A little something you learned from your dad, practical joke sort of.
And because, you know, one of the things my dad used to do is throw snakes in people's sleeping bags. That was his idea of a practical joke. So I was just taking it the next logical step. But as it turned out, the snake really wasn't dead. It was alive, and it was coiled up, and it would rattle. And so when my dad arrived to reach in blindly into the cooler, there was this rattlesnake that struck at him it got his attention, and I was the deserving end of that attention. But those are the type of jokes that we had played in my family.
And your dad had a peculiar toughness, and I don't know, maybe old school macho when it came to a manly world that he was...
It was a different generation, I suspect.
It was a less sensitive generation when it came to worrying about somebody else's injuries and pain. But one thing I really got a clue on without knowing that full story was there was always a little tiny thing after that that your dad was more guarded around you, and he was a little more guarded around me. You know, I mean, George Yard, old school, love that man. But my next question, which includes George, he had a dear friendship with my mother, Dorothea Durker. Dorothea Meyer.
They got along really well.
A great woman. A great woman, a great man, and they always got along great. But they were incredible people, our parents, those two.
Let me tell another story.
Yeah.
If we're talking about George Yard, we might as well tell a few more.
Let it roll.
Okay. Remember the Lake Powell story?
Yeah, we should go there.
Do you want to?
Absolutely.
It's long and drawn out.
Do you know my list? I have a little list I wrote down of how this might go, but my next mention or where I was going was Edgar Lee Hutchison.
This is an Edgar Lee Hutchison story.
Let it roll.
Okay. So early on in Flagstaff, mid-60s would be the setting, and Lake Powell, the location. A lot of the young men in their 30s and 40s, would go up and fish, even though there's no evidence that they ever fished, because nobody ever caught any fish or appeared to. They either were very poor fishermen, or they were up to something else, or there weren't any fish in Lake Powell at that time. But they had a good time, nevertheless. And so one of these times, I know my dad went up there. He didn't own a boat, but he would, people like Doug Wall, Edgar Lee Hutchison had boats and things like that. And they went up to Lake Powell, and my dad had an affliction at the time, which was pretty common for him. He had hemorrhoids, and they would flare up once in a while. And sure enough, on this particular trip, he gets up there to Lake Powell, and he has a great idea that he's among friends and things like that, and he's going to involve them in some surgery to eliminate his problem. And so to just kind of back up a hair and talk a little bit about the two primary characters. One was Doug Wall, practicing young attorney there in Flagstaff, and the other was Edgar Lee Hutchison. And Hutchison kind of managed three different ranches in and around Flagstaff area, northern Arizona. And he was a tough guy. So I remember one time on our ranch, we were throwing some calves, and as part of calves, you'd typically brand them in the fall. And if they're bull calves, you'd castrate them. And the whole trick is throw a rope. Somebody grabs the head, tosses the animal. Somebody grabs the hind legs. And you lay on the ground, you spread them, and you just kind of lock them in place. And somebody then can brand them so the animal doesn't get hurt. Or alternatively, you can castrate them, which entails grabbing the end of their scrotum and cutting it so the testicles come out. It's a rather gruesome thing, but the person that's holding the hind legs is right there. And I remember Lee Hutchison grabbed the tip of the scrotum and with a swipe of his knife cuts the scrotum through, and like a baseball player has this follow through such that he cuts open my dad's boots about 5-6 inches open, but has the dexterity that he doesn't cut any more than just the shoe leather right above the sole. Lays open his socks, but no blood. So obviously my dad thinks must be a good surgeon here. So they're back.
He had a liberal blade, but a precise blade.
Yeah. And so they get up there in Lake Powell. My dad decides to somehow talk Lee Hutchison into performing a surgery on his bunghole. Now, I don't know about you all, but just the thought of it makes my rectum pucker up to the point that you probably couldn't find my aperture. But, and so it makes you kind of wonder about the landscape down there and what he had instructed Lee Hutchison to do with his surgical knife. And I can guarantee you there were no pretty little surgical blades. It's likely Lee Hutchison's sharp pocket knife.
To keep our listeners up to date with
aghast?
What Mike's talking about, well, they're already aghast. We're talking about hemorrhoids, serious hemorrhoids, right?
So I've been told. Enough for my dad to want somebody to take a knife and cut them, which, you know, always has made us wonder in our family. But so he drew out in the sand what the landmarks were to be, where to make the incisions, how deep. And then he commences to drink a bottle of whiskey and lay spread eagle over the bow of the boat. And as the story...
As smart of a man as your father is, and as many stories as there are about him, it's the greatest lack of judgment of all the stories.
Anyway.
Especially if you knew Lee Hutchison, but go
ahead. As I remembered, so this is how the story goes. And I remember seeing my dad in bed. He was kind of convalescing at home and things like that. And afterwards, he recovered nicely. And he was rather braggadocious about the surgery that had been performed, such that he felt that most hemorrhoids reoccur with some degree of regularity, even after surgery. But his were fixed, good to go for a 10-year period. I mean, it's uncanny. He related it to taking one's car to the mechanic and having the tune-up and never having to go back again. So, but as it turns out, it wasn't
weird shit,
simple. It appears that Edgar Lee did a really good job. So good that he cut about an inch and a half too deep. And so
to that liberal blade.
They started getting worried as he was bleeding out in their boat as they were all trying to fish during that time period, my dad putting on a good face and such. And so they ended up, and I think this is where Doug Wall, the attorney, kind of goes, well, you know, what are we going to do with the body if he expires? So, you know, there's some practical thinking here. So they decide to take him to the clinic.
Your dad had some really neat friends.
Uh-huh, yeah. They were all kind of cut out of the same cloth. And so he gets patched up in a little clinic there at Page. And my dad, convalescing, vindictive man, I think, decides that he wants to now press charges, perhaps, on Edgar Lee Hutchison for malpractice. And so he talks this over with Doug Wall, and Doug informs my dad that, no, can't do malpractice because he's not a physician. But they could get him for practicing without a license. And so they hatch a plan, and this is where I think a number of doctors in the community decided to all get together, along with Doug. And they go down to Phoenix, they go to the Capitol, and they probably flatter some secretary or whatnot, but they get the governor's stationery with the official stamp. Boom.
As legend has it, the letterhead.
Yep, they have the letterhead. Then they construct the letter. And the letter basically was from the Arizona Board of Medicine, whatever it's called. And it identifies, it's a letter addressed to Edgar Lee Hutchison, who at the time was also an appointed person on the board of Flagstaff Medical Center. It had just finally turned into a community hospital. And as part of that, you'd have people there as part of the public, not part of the medical community, overseeing some of the actions in the hospital. And so you can't have a conflict of interest. You have to be separate than the medical community. Aha. So as part of the letter, they identify that it's come to their attention that Edgar Lee Hutchison has been practicing medicine without a license. And above all else, there appears to be a conflict of interest. And they feel that though his reputation is a good reputation in town, he has to tender his resignation there at the hospital. And it was signed officially, you know. And so a number of weeks went on. And I think Edgar Lee figured out that it was a hoax, because I remember not too long following that, a box arrived at the house, and Lee drops it off and tries to engage me in conversation. And I'm a little kid at that time. And I don't know if you grew up in that type of household, but kids were supposed to be seen and not heard. And I always thought it was a sinister plot of adults to try to engage you in conversation because they knew you were not supposed to speak. And so I yes, sir, no, sir. And I moved on and I gave the package to my dad and they opened it up. And sure enough, there was a rather elaborate package. And inside had a bottle of whiskey, had some Kleenex, and it had this contraption in it. And it was also with a letter was suggesting that he would like my dad to participate in trying to promote this new idea that Lee Hutchison had, which was a do-it-yourself hemorrhoid type of thing. And, you know, well ahead of the time for, you know,
and is this ahead of the malpractice letter or?
Yeah, this is following that.
Okay.
And so it's a package on how to do your own hemorrhoids. And with it, it had a little cosmetic mirror and an articulating thing. And at the end of it was this big, god-awful carpet knife hooked like a scimitar from Arabia. And you were supposed to kind of be able to see what was going on and hook the little culprit. And so, though, as I understand, the do-it-yourself little hemorrhoid maker or remover never really caught on. But, you know, who knows now
see,
in the future.
See, that's part of that story. I've never heard that Lee has
a good sense of humor as
shucks.
Well.
Lee Hutchison was a very caring father-like figure in my life and your life. And he was a remarkable old ranch sort of style guy, but he also sold used cars and, you know, whatever it took to feed his family and stuff. Great family, the Hutchison family. But first time I've ever heard that he cleverly responded to that legal jeopardy he was in because of that letter. He never bought it for a second. He never really bought any bullshit old Lee Hutchison. That's fantastic. Leading into our existence together, I want to talk about high school. Fantastic years we had at Flagstaff High School, at the foot of Frisco Mountain, under skies of blue. But we were both into athletics in a big way, and we played football together, Mike, and I want this part of the visit. I've always been super proud of the fact that even though we got beat to death by most of the teams we played, you and I shared a great honor. We were MVPs our senior year, and it was the only time Flagstaff High School ever bestowed that honor to two people. And we shared our senior year, we shared Most Valuable Player Award. And I remember that night, your dad and my mom were proud of that. It was beautiful, and we were both terrible football players.
I don't know about that. You got a full ride down to U of A.
No, but that's a proud thing you and I have always shared. Wouldn't you agree?
Mm-hmm.
The way things shook out, I want to talk a little bit about your education. I really have always been a big fan of Mike Yard's work, and I want to talk a little bit about your journey to a PhD, a little bit, you know, because you and I were both super involved with your interest by the time it was maybe going to be a master's. And I want to just have it mentioned that, you know, everybody figured out what your deal was. And so they kind of fast forward you to a PhD rather than a master's. Can you talk a little bit about how that went?
Well, I think rather than dwelling on so much that, just the it's interesting for me to look back and recognize all the opportunities that have come to both of us in different ways. And as you mentioned earlier in our conversation, it's difficult to get to be a guide, a boatman, whatever you call it, in Grand Canyon. But the more difficult path is to then stay. It's hard. It's much harder to keep your foot in the door.
To keep your place, yeah.
And one way of staying there doesn't necessarily mean that that's the way for everybody. Everybody has to figure out how they can stay, if they want to stay. And it is a difficult way of running through life, trying to, if you love Grand Canyon, like you, myself, and many others, it's a difficult place to try to maintain yourself professionally. And for me, my start and falling in love with Grand Canyon has solely to do with you being drawn into working down in Grand Canyon from right out of high school and on, opened up a lot of future careers. I was obviously interested in biology and got my undergrad work there. And then following that, our effort to try to be entrepreneurs and provide the logistical and technical support for a lot of the early science efforts propelled me into an opportunity to work with Glen Canyon Environmental Studies and Phase 1, Phase 2, and the same with you, working on it from a different angle. Both of us, I think, took opportunity, but also had some insight on where it should go and assisted in that process. And so it was, for me, inevitable that I needed to get higher degrees and followed up with some work on primary production as part of my PhD at NAU. But I think the overall career track that each of us took was unique, and it was, you know, all over the map. But looking back at it, it all makes sense. It all has a linearity to it that's explainable. And I think both of us, in certain ways, were instrumental in making some major changes and helping science progress forward in Grand Canyon. I think one of the things that people don't recognize is how helpful you were in as far as boats and crafts and such. And back in the early 80s, you know, both of us came from a company, a commercial company that was predominantly oar powered. And so motors were a little bit foreign to us. And one of the first trips, I recall being just above the LCR, rowing down, and seeing both you and Steve Carruthers come flying out of the LCR confluence mouth in a little tiny sport boat at the time, a little Boston Whaler, maybe 10 foot in length, and God knows what the beam was, tiny. And it was just doing a wheelie out of that thing, and I was just amazed. Because up until then, I think most rivers were unidirectional. You go with the flow. You put in, you take out somewhere else. And yet science, I think, has been in your debt on having realized the potential for the use of sport boats that allows for not only going downstream, but staying in place and repeat sampling. Replication is extremely important for science, as well as being able to move equipment back and forth and having the ability to have upstream mobility is essential for that. And we started with using, you know, military surplus equipment that is poorly designed for doing rivers, as we know. And in that process, refining that equipment, as well as boats and what boats were available and the application of those boats for those particular needs. And the sport boat itself and the evolution of that through time has been instrumental in so many applications, electrofishing being one. Doing a lot of the surveying and things like that and setting things up. But electrofishing and being able to resample an area the following evening and the following evening after that has allowed for quantification of stuff that we've never been able to do prior to that. The mark recapture approach that we are currently using is essential in understanding fish populations, population dynamics.
And how you model and
Yeah, and so quantitative biology can't be done in a river without the ability to resample that with some degree of frequency. And sport boats are an essential item for that. And that didn't come about just instantly. It was, you know, trial and error process of finding the right boats, right engines, the right application of those things. And so that was essential and was a breakthrough for science that has influenced not only the hydroacoustic work that's doing on mapping underwater sediment, but also just keeping track of fish along the shoreline and getting an idea of fish community dynamics and such. So, yeah, my hats are off to you. Thank you.
That's generous, but, you know, back to, before we get ahead of ourselves on those elements, it was an amazing start we had. And I agree with you, we had some remarkable timing and opportunity as far as where we're at with Grand Canyon, right? You and I. But the wonderful ride we've been on in regards to some of the finite aspects of the Grand Canyon are what this conversation's all about. In your case, it's the fishery now, but I don't think very many people realize the big picture that you have brought into the overall outlook scientifically of these remarkable inner digitized features of the system, right? The big picture stuff. What I remember in the early game is your interest in the grasses or those things as far as your biological passions. But let's talk about light attenuation and the actual aquatic productivity. And I think it's still a super relevant thing which led to your PhD, and that's what I'm kind of getting at.
To give it some context, there was a nice book for general laymen put together by Carruthers and Brown that kind of laid out the hypothesis that due to the presence of the dam and the change that came about from the dam on the physical template of the river, both in altering the flow, the temperature, and the sediment characteristics, as well as one of the underappreciated things, which is the amount of organics that used to move through the system. That all was altered, that physical template of the river. And some of those things, like organics and sediment, are sequestered behind the dam in Lake Powell. The thermal characteristics changed from something that's seasonally variable in temperature to something that was constant, centrothermic, cold. So you have this altered template. We then, Johnny Apple, bucketed our favorite fish in there. So we've had a lot of non-natives that have been introduced. They become problematic. And one of the things that Carruthers and Brown identified in their book was this hypothesis that you've altered the trophic pathways of how energy moves through that system. And now that it is a clear water system, it is conducive for primary production. And that primary production in some ways had perhaps replaced the flow of organics that were originally moving through that.
And just for clarification for the listener, what we're talking about is a pre-dam scenario to where you have these seasonal high flows, spring flows, water coming from the mountains, you know, a traditional river
sediment
scenario.
Sediment-laden river, sediment, warm.
Sediment rich to what we have now post-dam is sediment starved in a lot of ways as far as replacement sediment. And also what Mike's talking about is this natural system, those nutrients
and, system. And broadly organics. You think about how the rivers function. They transport material. That material can be both physical, like sediment, of different particle sizes, as well as the organics from big trees down to little bark to little tiny pieces of wood, leaves, down to the dissolved organic component. And in a lot of ways, it's analogous to a circulatory system. It's moving this material down through all the different connections, the
right.
different networks of streams to smaller and larger rivers, and ultimately to the ocean. And that transport of organics, in a sense, is the energy that drives all the invertebrates in the system, as well as fish. And they make their livelihood by partitioning up these organics and their availability. But by building a dam, alters that template and makes it more similar to headwater streams, small streams. They're clear. They have primary producers like algae that then capture light. That light energy is then moved up through the food chain through invertebrates and fish. But in dark, bigger river systems like the Colorado River, it's predominantly driven by this movement of organics, what we call allochthonous. It's material from somewhere else that's moving through the system. So the dam put a check on the transport of that, not only of sediment, but of that organic material. And so the big question is the amount of energy that's used from bottom up through the different trophic levels, was there less energy? Is there less food available for the fish communities?
So your big question is primary production.
As one of those pathways.
As part of that.
Yeah.
Right.
And so one, I wanted to characterize the optical properties of the river by trying to correlate the sediment concentration, that as you increase sediment concentration, it in a sense turns the lights out in the system. There is less light reaching the bed of the river. And I wanted to come up with different models to describe the movement of that, as well as come develop models to predict primary production. And it was to really kind of address this hypothesis of Carruthers and Brown on whether or not primary production was the primary driver of the flow of energy through the Colorado River. I would say that it's one pathway, and it's definitely primary production produces very labile, highly coveted, desired products. The allochthonous organics are more refractory. They take a lot of processing and a lot of energy by invertebrates to use and move that energy.
For accessibility.
So, yeah. And so it's not to say that primary production is the primary pathway of the flow of energy currently, but it is probably one of the more important sources of energy currently, particularly in the Glen Canyon area and then down through the Marble Canyon reach and such. And then it moves towards more organics that are coming from tributaries and other secondary sources from the land itself as material is washed in and such.
I want to talk about when I was running the river. I started with McCallum and stuff, and I was always coming off the river, and everybody was going, "Where's Brian?" Because, you know, people were playing baseball, everybody was in town, this, that, and the other. But I remember as close as you and I were, it was like, you got to jump on this deal here. And I remember how mad I was seeing this opportunity Mike Yard had to get on the river. Dude, you got to
not acting on it.
And you pissed me off huge because instead of jumping the opportunity, you rode your horse to the rendezvous. So I want to talk about riding your horse from Flagstaff to
rendezvous. it wasn't quite that way, you know.
clarify.
For example, on your first river trip, you had a cast of characters, your brother being one, but Barney Anderson and Ted Layton were on that particular trip as well.
Yeah, that 1970.
And they were some of my dad's occasional cowboy hands that would show up at the ranch. And I remember in particular that summer after that particular trip, they were on cloud nine about how wonderful of a time.
How incredible.
Unbelievable. And so from that point in time, I was extremely interested. But like I said, I was an indentured servant to my father in his aspiration of having a working ranch. It just, the opportunity wasn't there and in time for me. And you did get me down there a couple of times, though I wasn't on the trip with you, but with your brother Dan and Don Neff. And that was instrumental. That
planted a seed of sorts.
Right. But I think a lot of people don't realize, or at least some don't realize, that when you and I were growing up, Vietnam was raging at the time. And there were two options. There was, at some point, you're likely to either go to war or you are going to attempt to defer by going to college. I think I suspected I was to be cannon fodder. And so that was the inevitable direction that I was likely to go.
Now, this is interesting because I remember how close we were. There was still a draft.
There was still a draft.
Graduating.
Yeah.
Right?
And the draft had finally been canceled in 73. And everybody was hardwired to go to school, to defer. And it just seemed stupid because just to go to avoid the draft for the purposes of going to school, you should be have an objective of what you are intending on doing. So I took full opportunity of saying, I'm not going that way. And nowadays you might call it a gap year or whatever. But for me, it was like, no, I am...
neither of us were going to go over there and kill people.
Yeah. And
never what we were going to do.
I might have been killed there, but I had no intention
We'd
of killing
people. We'd have
been
terrible soldiers.
Yeah. But, you know, so it was kind of a release. And college was not something I wanted to do. And I really did enjoy the river trips I was doing. And it, but I was... I kind of just checked out, and
And for the listener, hello, Mike was always a peculiar man. I guess that's why we were such good friends. But you were living outskirts in the woods, and
you came to my little at that time period. Remember the forest?
I remember going out to your little enclave out there. Yeah. You bet.
The Forest Service at that time, due to people like myself, were trying to get rid of line shacks that had been put into the forest. And so probably through the 70s and maybe into the 80s, the Forest Service burnt down and dismantled an enormous amount of line shacks that were distributed through the national forest, not only in Arizona, but throughout everywhere, to avoid having squatters like myself that would set up.
And for the listener, what Mike's talking about is he went off the grid. But go ahead.
And so I had this one particular line shack that was outside of town, maybe 30 miles of town, and I lived there, and I think I fancied myself as a David Thoreau, and I'd spend most of my time reading books and wandering around trying to figure out how to acquire enough food to feed myself.
Skinning roadkill. And
I wouldn't necessarily go that far, but it was, you know, at the time, an option. And
I love this conversation. This is what we really want to be talking about right now, because our paths after the glory of our losing football team MVP award, we graduate from college and I go off to U of A to play football. You went off the grid.
I hightail it out into the woods.
And I remember even when I was playing football, you and I were still super tight. You came down and witnessed me being reprimanded and running laps on the football team. And I remember coming out into the woods and checking out your off-the-grid shit. I mean, we've always been besties. And I always had great respect for what you were doing, and you were always a real supporter of what I was doing, but I'm not sure either of us had very much figured out. Wouldn't you agree? We were both idiots. It kind of brings to mind Into the Wild, in that transition of being a child to adult. You start realizing it's a mean old world instead of the perfect world, because all of a sudden your brain has developed enough to where you can realize it's an imperfect world.
And I think, you're hitting it. I think we were growing up in a time period where we were disappointed, not unlike what might be going on currently with, you know, in this case, Watergate, Nixon, the Pentagon Papers.
But not so much that. What about fucking Vietnam?
And all of that. And I think, as well as other societal issues, it was raging at that same time period, the American Indian Movement. And so that was the backdrop that we were going to school, and I think it strongly influenced us. I do remember I was moved tremendously by Paul Ehrlich's book on the population bomb, Barry Commoner's books. You know, it seemed likely that things weren't looking good for humankind. And so, what, as you say, going off the grid, but, you know, taking more of a simpler, anachronistic lifestyle is really what I sought. Something simple and trying to live off the land.
Well, and I think that really influenced me, like, in my decision-making is the stubborn free thinking of a best friend living off the grid and the elements I was living under in Tucson, doing three-a-days with a bunch of, in a lot of ways, clones. If you've ever been on a gigantic team, big program team and stuff, I mean, you start looking around and, you know, you go through certain experiences to where you are a clone, to where I think your individuality, that is the most remarkable damn thing if you think about a young, you know, like a Christopher McCandless getting on a horse with a couple fanatics, which is basically what you did, and rode from the bottom of this country to the top. I want the listener to get a load of this big adventure.
So at about that same time, I ended up meeting this rather interesting individual named Jeff Hengesbaugh, and he and a number of other people, and they were probably 10 years my senior. A number of them had served overseas, been in Vietnam. Some had good experiences, some had poor experiences. And they had wished to do a reenactment and go up to this rendezvous. And in 1825, at the Henry's Fork of the Green River, was the first mountain man rendezvous. Prior to then, trading posts had been established in certain areas. And the idea was that people, either Indian tribes, would bring furs and pelts, or the pioneers, early individuals, entrepreneurs, would go inland and acquire those animals and bring them to the trading posts. Those trading posts were established by Alida, is related to John Astor. And the more newer way of doing it was this idea of kind of forming bands of people, in this case, as we call them nowadays, mountain men, to go inland into the Rockies and such, and trap and bring pelts and whatnot back on an annual basis. And so the first rendezvous occurred there at Henry's Fork of the Green River. Bridger was there, Jeremiah Johnson,
big names, but wait. Around, what was that like?
That was in 1825. And so one of the things...
Early, 1825.
And so I was going to go with these three men, myself, and we were to ride along the western flank of the Colorado and Rockies, and then eventually go to this area. But unlike prior people of that time, 150 years earlier, you didn't have to contend with highways, houses, and things like that. Most of the paths and routes that people probably took at that time period are now the same places that you see highways and interstates laid down. So it was very difficult trying to avoid those areas.
Mountain passes, river passage, the same stuff that the early people chose to get from point A to B. But before we go there, who were these guys?
Oh, so one of them was Jeff Hengesbaugh. The other one was Greg Guyman. And then Daryl Flood. They all came from different backgrounds and things like that. One of them...
But at the time, I was like, it was remarkable, you know, the influence they had on you, which was positive and, in my eyes, annoying. But also, one of them was a absolute encyclopedia of knowledge of the Native American. I think a lot of it was Plains, wasn't it?
Yeah. You know, they each came in with different backgrounds and things like that. And why they would adopt a little greenhorn like myself to go along with them, who knows? But I spent probably 8 months prior to the ride tanning leather, you know.
I painfully and pridefully followed a lot of that 8 months.
And it was just preparatory. And I had a riding horse and a pack horse and, tried to make or acquire things of that time. And so we started all of our fires with flint and steel at best we could live off the land. And what we needed as far as staples, we carried on our pack horses.
And for the listener, I was there during those preparations and you were educating me. You know, we were good friends and stuff, and you along the way were educating me the difference between a brain tan and a, you know,
chemical sulfur.
Tan, or you, in so many different ways, kind of educated me about a bunch of hardcore traditional elements that you guys were going to write up there in hardcore traditional form, right? I mean, it's like,
well, I don't think it was being hardcore so much as it was trying, like you said, to educate yourself. And probably at that time period, the people that knew how to live on that land in harmony in some way were the Native Americans. And so a lot of the skill sets were borrowed or stolen, depending on how you like to look at it, by the Western movement of the early colonists. And so their ability to skin, tan, and sew with the materials at hand, whether it be sinew or plant fibers, and whether they lived in the plains or in the Rockies with the plants and animals that were available.
They're resourceful.
And they're very resourceful. And so it was, you know, a hard school of knocks in some ways, but there are in a lot of books and people that at that time that were knowledgeable about that. And you could acquire some information, though you'd have to, you know, make a guess on how they might have done this. And so the assembling of the materials to get ready for the journey, let alone what works on your way and adapting to things that broke and didn't hold muster to the circumstances.
Oh, exactly. It was such an education just being around that focus that you had for me. I always appreciated the effect it had on both of us. I may as well say it in regards to religion. I think it made both of us, like, you know, we were never church going fellows, either of us, but we still were very spiritual about that relationship with the planet or the earth or the land.
Yeah, I think you're right. Neither of us, even to this day, are caught up with organized religion. But I think we recognize the awe of nature and are moved by it. And whether or not there's a moving hand, I'm not so sold on that. But the Native Americans and the people of that time, you know, appear to have been in harmony with the land. And so I think at the time I found some fascination with that and exploring that.
Yeah, all that stuff I think really had a great effect on both of us. And, you know, if you look back on our early river running days, it was like we could be down there with a pair of shorts and a
set of
sandals.
We ran it pretty minimal.
We were pretty minimal. But I think looking back on it, it really educated me, like being around your preparation for that trip. I was always a little concerned about these boys you were hanging out with.
They were rough.
So let's get back to that.
As a group, we set off from Canyon Diablo, just east of Flagstaff, and rode across the reservation. And occasionally, you know, you'd have to hobble your animals or picket them every night. Sometimes animals would get away. They oftentimes go back exactly to the same place that they were the day before. So, you know, you're moving forward and you're taking a step backwards sometimes if you lose your livestock. And so it's, you know, you're moving across the land, and it's not just a linear direction. There are things that happen and such. And I do remember when we were fording the Little Colorado, there were some issues that developed with my older friends. And in particular with this one individual, I think we all recognized that he was having some mental issues, that there was something that was really bothering him. And none of us at the time felt very safe. And I remember ultimately a fight breaking out, and we had to hold him off at gunpoint and force him out of the group because of some tendencies that looked like that he was going to become psychotic and perhaps threaten our lives. And so we separated at that point. But I just like, in a way, river trips too, throw people together. And that's the beauty of trips, river trips in particular, for a period of time. Sometimes you have people of different backgrounds and whatnot, and it does allow for people to come together. And once in a while, which makes a great river trip story, there are problems that arise. And hopefully not like what we had encountered, but nevertheless, sometimes it doesn't work out and you have to figure out the best means to proceed along. And this individual in particular was kind of living in the past. I mean, we were trying to emulate in something that had occurred 150 years ago. And quite honestly, I think he was living 150 years earlier and had perhaps some of the
potential to kill you.
Yeah.
Terrifying.
Yeah. Anyway, it was a good trip. We marched our way.
So off he went.
Yeah. We separated ways.
And he turned back or what?
From what I understand. And he's fine. I have not kept up with him at all. But
in regards to your firearms, was it black powder?
I had a replica piece that was similar to a long rifle that you would have found on the East Coast in 1810 or so. It was fairly accurate. I also had a couple pistols that were black powder. I really wouldn't put them at any time period. They were more modern day replicas. And then I had a double barreled percussion shotgun that had come from England. And it was, you know, part of the feudal state in Lourdes. And it was a period. And it was probably 1840, 1842.
Oh, wow.
So it's an old timepiece. But
yeah, I remember playing around with the black powder a little bit.
Yeah, it's interesting, and it kind of begs the question about current types of guns and modern gunpowder versus the old-fashioned black powder. It's, you know, you have to keep your powder dry, you might say. You know, there were a lot of skill sets of how to maintain those firearms, and they weren't necessarily accurate. And
what'd you do about feed and stuff?
We'd picket our animals in the evenings, and we wouldn't ride all day, depending on the overall availability of browse and grass and such. And so you'd have to maintain your animals, just like gassing up your vehicle. And you would make, in areas where they could easily acquire feed, then you could put them out during the evening and you were ready to go the next day. Other times you might have to sit in a place for a period of time and make sure that they have enough food, that they've eaten enough. And so you're balancing the miles that you're making a day versus making sure your animals are in good standing.
Maintenance of the animals.
Yeah.
And as you made your way, do you have highlights as far as the more difficult stretches and stuff?
I think the area between Grand Junction and Rangeley, the kind of the Badlands area there, the Book Cliffs, that was a difficult area, hard to get feed, take care of the horses, the intermittent water, you know, because we weren't using water until our animals had water. And so, you know, moving from available water, whether it was streams, tanks.
How much water could you carry?
We typically didn't. We would, you know, there were times near the San Juan River on that side, coming off the Chuscas, dropping down into that stretch, moving towards Farmington area, where Farmington is today. That is pretty limited as far as water. And I remember
I can only imagine. I mean,
I remember we went for about a day and a half without any potable water for animals as well as ourselves. And we were straggling all the way to the San Juan River. So there were times that we went without water, our animals went without water. And I suppose our upbringing in Flagstaff, belonging to the Raisin Clan, helped us a little bit. But I think we're in the habit of always thinking that we need to drink water and at some degree of frequency through the course of the day. And that's an optimum way of doing it. But as a human, humans are really well adapted to handle periods without water. And
what do you mean by the Raisin Clan?
That's how I like to think of people from Flagstaff that grew up in Flagstaff.
They don't drink enough water.
They're just a bunch of shriveled up raisins. But, you know, I think human beings and our little lineage of being bipedal apes, they're very adaptable to their local environment. And, and so it's easy to see how different cultures have come about and adapted to that given environment.
Overall, we're talking about what length of time?
It took about 3 months.
To get up there?
Yeah. And it was a roundabout way. And during that period, I ended up what we think might have been Rocky Mountain spotted fever. It kind of incapacitated me for about a 2-week period.
And where were you when you...
Probably south of where Grand Junction is currently. And we were kind of jumping back and forth across those big plateaus. And I do recall they ended up dragging me down to what is now known as Gateway. But it wasn't, matter of fact, the other day I drove through Gateway and didn't recognize it. I mean, it's just overly developed. But it was, and a rancher there and his wife took care of me for over a week. And I recuperated there. So in a lot of ways, I would have probably died otherwise. So.
So you've been on the horse for 3 months. You're closer and closer, and then the rendezvous. What was that like?
It was fun. And there were a lot of people that came from different areas. There were probably, 50, 60 teepees set up.
And where exactly was the rendezvous?
It was up Henry's Fork. It, which is on the western side of the Green, runs in to the Green River. Now, Flaming Gorge exists there and Fontenelle Reservoir, and Fontenelle has backed it up. And so it's inundated the original location of where that rendezvous was. So there was an area probably about 10 miles up from what would have been the confluence, and it was kind of a cottonwood gallery, about a half a mile of the area. And there were a lot of people that had, in that case, driven there, not ridden there. And they had set up a number of teepees. And they were just people of different walks of life that had started what now has become a very popular thing to do. But at the time, that was the first rendezvous.
Oh, wow. It was the first one.
And I don't know to what degree. It's the only one I've ever attended.
but it's probably like Burning Man. It gets
popular. I think it's probably...
what it was.
Yeah. But there were a lot of different people that really were interested in the time period. And I learned a lot from them. And they were great people. Yeah.
And so you just encamped and enjoyed the festivities once you got there?
Yeah. And then I ended up leaving my horses there. I ended up hitchhiking back to Flagstaff. And shortly following that, then you ended up contacting me, and we went down on the river. And then following that, I went back up with a horse trailer and brought those animals back.
Yeah, so, I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Unreal. That is a big adventure right there. And with that, we've run out of time. And I know you have to go. So in the next...
I look forward to the next one.
Next
great big adventure.
Big adventure. But I'll tell you what, thank you for sharing that one with us. And the other thing is we haven't even scratched the surface yet. So stay right side up, keep your bottom down.
Big Adventures is produced by Brian Durker, Margaret Knight, and me, Gavin Buchner. Bill Gleckler and his mandolin provide our music. If you like our show, please subscribe on whatever platform you listen to podcasts.